Good morning and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call with Douglas Fife. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. We have a large audience today. We're thrilled and hope you keep sending the invitation to your friends. Because we have so many new people with us today, let me provide an introduction to the JPC and our work. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization providing perspective and analysis of foreign and domestic policies by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. You can sign up for our articles and see our magazine In Focus Quarterly by going to the website. That's www.jewishpolicycenter.org. And if you've missed some of our conference calls, each one ends up on the website. So I encourage you to look at www.jewishpolicycenter.org to see what you might have missed and send it to your friends. In this series of calls, we've been trying to shift people's focus from the health aspects of the coronavirus pandemic to its impact on the internal and foreign policy choices of countries that are America's friends and that are America's adversaries. This morning, our guest is Douglas Fife, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, where he works on a range of foreign and defense issues, writing and lecturing on terrorism, arms control, alliance relations, national security policy, and the relationship between policy and intelligence. His projects at Hudson have examined U.S. policy toward East and South Asia, Australia, Europe, and the Middle East. And in his spare time, he's writing a history of the Arab-Israel conflict, which I, for one, am really looking forward to. Doug served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from July 2001 to August 2005. War and Decision, his best-selling memoir of his Pentagon work on the War on Terror, was published in 2008. While in the Defense Department, he helped plan worldwide changes in the U.S. defense posture, also develop new U.S. strategic partnerships with India and Pakistan, promote NATO enlargement and reform, and craft U.S. policy toward China. And China and Israel and the United States is where he is going to focus our attention today. Remember, as you listen, although your phone is muted, you can send questions to us during the presentation by email. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org, info@jewishpolicycenter.org. Doug, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. I want to thank the Jewish Policy Center and Shoshana Bryan for this chance to talk to all of you out there in the ether. As any of you who has been reading the newspapers lately, especially the newspapers relating to U.S.-Israeli relations, knows, Israel has to think carefully about China and the national security implications of its economic ties to China, even though many Israelis, most Israelis, don't see China as a direct threat to themselves. Now, why does Israel have to think so carefully about China? Well, there's several reasons, but one reason I think one could say is enough, and that is that Israel has a major interest in the United States and America's principal national security concern is China. Now, why the U.S. worries about China and China's economic ties to Israel are matters that I've discussed in recent articles that I published in the Wall Street Journal and the Jerusalem Post and on the Hudson Institute website. And I would encourage people who are interested in a more detailed discussion to to look up those articles. I don't know whether Shoshana has distributed either the articles or links. What I'd like to spend a few minutes on now is the observation that this issue of the triangular relations of the United States, Israel, and China has become important and pressing only fairly recently. And I think it's worth reviewing the history of how this problem arose to understand why we're in the situation that we're in, and why we have all started reading about this subject in the last year or two, but it wasn't much of a subject at all more than about 2 or 3 years ago. What has made this topic front and center is what we have learned about the strategy of China under Xi Jinping, under its president. And Xi Jinping only came to power a few years ago in 2012. And he became president of China in 2013. And he then spent several years consolidating his power over the Communist Party, over the government, over the economy, and over the military. And only since he has consolidated his power and promulgated his new aggressive and nationalistic national security policy has the United States focused on China as the threat that we now generally across the political spectrum in the United States recognize China to be. So let's do a little bit of a historical review, because U.S. official perceptions of China have evolved over recent decades. Obvious place to start this little historical review is the famous meeting in 1972 between President Nixon and Chairman Mao. The so-called opening to China was an important strategic move in the Cold War. And basically the idea was that the United States, which had no relations with Communist China, initiated those relations in order to use China as a counterweight against the USSR in the Cold War. So the initial outreach to China was part of our Cold War strategy. But it evolved into something more than that. And there was a widespread view, especially after Mao was succeeded by Deng Xiaoping, and Deng Xiaoping made major economic reforms in China. There was a sense that those economic reforms, if they were greeted by a welcoming attitude on the part of the United States and the West in general, could lead to the liberalization, not only of the Chinese economy, but of China's politics. And there was a widespread belief for several decades that if the United States and the West helped China grow economically, and transferred technology to China, and assisted China to enter the World Trade Organization, for example, that the effect of this was that China would grow economically stronger, but would increase its appreciation of the importance of integrating China into the world's advanced economies. And by doing that, China would become more responsible, people would get wealthy in China, there would be pressure from the middle class for more democratic rights, and China would liberalize both domestically and internationally. And now I just want to pause here and make the point that the little bit of history that I've just given you about how what the United States attitude was, and the fact that the United States really did work very hard to promote trade with China, to promote Chinese economic growth, to promote U.S. technology transfer to China, to welcome Chinese students in American universities, to assist China to enter the World Trade Organization and defend China against accusations that it wasn't living up to all of its obligations in the World Trade Organization. All of those things are true. And we did them, and we did them on a sustained basis for decades. And it's important to note this because recent Chinese propaganda has argued that the United States for a century and more has tried to keep China down and has tried to prevent China from growing and rising, as the saying goes, and that we've opposed the rise of China, not just militarily, but economically, and we've wanted China to remain, you know, small and impoverished. That's absolutely not true, but it is a major theme of Chinese propaganda now, and it's important to know that the history does not bear that out. Now, while we were doing this in the period between Deng Xiaoping's accession to power in the late 70s and through the 90s, China's strategy was a strategy that was famously encapsulated by Deng Xiaoping, and it was known as the hide and bide strategy. And that was short for Deng Xiaoping's famous declaration that China should hide your strength, bide your time, and never take the lead. Deng's idea behind this strategy was that if the Chinese became too assertive too early, then the great powers, the United States in particular, would be alarmed and would be able to stifle China's growth. And so Deng said that China wants to grow, wants to become powerful, but it should do so in a cautious fashion, hiding strength, biding its time, and not taking the lead. And that was the policy that China pursued for quite a while. Now, during the George W. Bush years, when I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the way I and many of my colleagues talked about China as a strategic matter was that there was a great debate. There was a great debate underway in China, which we saw in the Chinese literature. The debate actually made it into publicly available literature among Chinese officials and academics and thinkers. And that debate was a debate over what is the path to Chinese national greatness. And some people argued strongly in favor of maintaining the Deng Xiaoping strategy, the hide and bide strategy, and said China should grow economically, integrate with the West, build up its strength, and it would achieve national greatness in a cautious, careful fashion of integrating with the world. But there was another school of thought that was more nationalistic, more aggressive, more militaristic, and that said the time has come for China to emerge from the hide and bide strategy, and it should take its place in the world. It should dominate its region. It should get deference from its neighbors, and it should be more aggressive in confronting the United States and the West. And that debate was underway. And what a number of the top officials in the Bush administration said in the George W. Bush years was, we were hopeful that the first school could prevail in that debate and that China would not become aggressive and a major problem for the United States. And we wanted to shape the environment in which that debate was occurring to strengthen the hand of the people who were in favor more of Chinese integration into the world and better behavior than the more aggressive and nationalistic and militaristic school. But then Xi Jinping, as I said, came to power in 2012, 2013, and started building up his, consolidating his power and building up his domination of the whole Chinese government and party and military apparatus. And Xi Jinping has essentially resolved that debate. And the school that is more nationalistic, more aggressive, more militaristic has won the debate. And Chinese strategy has become aggressive toward its neighbors. I mean, the Chinese are asserting sovereignty and ownership over the South China Sea. They are aggressively intimidating their neighbors. They're sinking their fishing vessels. They're disrupting their economic activities in the South China Sea. They've been threatening. They've been building up their military and in a display that violates the old principles of Deng Xiaoping's hide and bide. They've clearly moved. They've transcended that. They've moved beyond the Deng Xiaoping strategy. And Xi's strategy has alarmed China's neighbors and has put the United States clearly on notice that the Chinese are intent on challenging the United States' traditional role in maintaining international order, in pushing the United States certainly out of Asia and even beyond. And the Chinese have set themselves up as a very aggressive rival to the United States and a serious potential military threat. And this is not because the United States was opposing Chinese growth, and it was because China just decided that its time has come. And the Xi Jinping strategy has registered, but only in recent years, because it's basically emerged only in recent years. And when I say in recent years, I mean the last 5, 6, 7 years. And so measures by the United States to respond began somewhat tentatively under the Obama administration. And then since President Trump has come to office, the United States has taken, in some respects, much stronger action, rhetorically and otherwise, to challenge the Chinese. And President Trump has sent kind of mixed signals on this. Sometimes he's very laudatory of President Xi, but at other times, he's very critical of Chinese trade policies and military activities. But his administration, the current administration, has a number of officials that have laid out a strong policy of opposition to China's more aggressive economic and military policies. And the fact that the Obama administration began to make this shift has resulted in a very interesting phenomenon, which is Trump's strong policies against China have been endorsed by a number of the leading Obama national security people, so that you have this interesting phenomenon that in our current era, which is so highly polarized, the major national security problem for the United States, which is the dealing with the China threat, is an unusual area of pretty broad left to right consensus among national security commentators and officials. And it's just noteworthy that, you know, there isn't that much that you get broad based left to right political support on. But the general idea that we have to stand up to China more boldly is one of those areas. And that's a good thing for the country. Now, the United States is, as a result of this, is faced with an unprecedented challenge. How to deal with a strategic rival that is a major player in the world economy. We've never had that problem before. In dealing with the Soviet Union, we were dealing with a country that was a major military threat, but was not a significant player in the world economy. China is. We have extensive economic ties to China. There's a question of how should the United States regulate its own commercial relations with China. This is a very difficult question, and we don't have a full answer to the question, even for the United States. We also have the question, how should the United States encourage U.S. allies and partners around the world to regulate their commercial relations with China in light of Xi Jinping's very aggressive strategy? And so the United States is developing the answers for itself on how to regulate its own economy and its own economic relations with China, at the same time that it's encouraging allies and partners around the world to adopt their regulations appropriately. And the United States is talking to, working with, quarreling with the British, the Australians, the Germans, the Japanese, and others on these very difficult questions. And this is the context in which the current U.S.-Israeli dialogue is taking place on the proper way for Israel to regulate its economic relations with China in light of Chinese strategy and American interests regarding Chinese strategy. And so I think it's important to see what's happening with Israel as part of a much larger effort, and part of an effort that is not a long-standing, decades-old effort. It's an effort that that basically has been developing only in the last 6, 7 years or so, as a quick reaction to the disappointment of all the hopes that American officials had for decades that China's economic rise was going to cause liberalization and a kind of convergence of policies between China and the West. Those theories of liberalization and convergence have been refuted by President Xi, and they have presented the United States with a major challenge. And the United States is now working with Israel and many other allies and partners around the world to confront that challenge. Anyway, with that, I think I'll stop and be happy to take the questions.
We have a number of questions that are going to go directly to the issue of China-Israel. But the first question is a more general one. Given the fungibility of technology applications and high-value commercial products that result from research and development innovations, in which Israel is a world leader, is the distinction between military and non-military, or security and non-security trade, useful anymore? Israel, of course, does no direct military trade with China.
Well, that's an important question. And the answer to that question has changed in recent decades. If you go back 30 years or so, there was a very clear distinction between military technology and commercial technology. And in general, the most advanced technology was military. So if you think about it, supercomputers were developed by military and intelligence agencies in the West, and they were the most advanced computers. And then other things that were highly advanced then would get adopted by commercial providers, and so you had the major developments occurring in the military and intelligence sphere, and commercial spin-offs of those technologies. But what's happened in the last few decades is that the most advanced technologies are not developed by the militaries in the West, and they're not accessible only to a handful of people who have security clearances. The most advanced technologies are commercial. And you have military and intelligence agencies chasing after commercial technologies to find the right applications for them. And so this poses a really serious challenge, because you can't regulate these commercial technologies the same way that you could regulate technologies that could be labeled specifically military or defense technologies in the old days. And so this is one of the reasons that the question of how to regulate economic relations with China is so difficult. Now, there's another problem, and that is things that in the old days were not considered to be relevant to national security are now relevant because of the particular approaches that the Chinese government has taken. So, for example, what the Chinese are doing is they are developing technology to refine their surveillance capabilities to maintain political control in China. And they're developing technologies to monitor people, to surveil their public, to control private communications, control speech, control thought for all practical purposes, and be able to track people. And so they have an interest in the personal details of people's lives, which they can use with artificial intelligence, computing power, so that they can have a kind of totalitarian control over their population. Now, those same kinds of tools of mastery of personnel data can also be used internationally to intimidate people, to intimidate critics abroad of China, to recruit people for intelligence purposes. And so all kinds of data about individuals that we would have thought had no national security implications at all, large information sources about how people shop and what they buy and what their personal habits are and what they read and what websites they look at on the internet. Those are things that now the Chinese are developing the ability to exploit, not just for their own populations, but even in populations outside of China. And so that has made the United States extremely sensitive to how the Chinese connect to major databases and to internet service providers throughout the West. And so all kinds of things that were not thought of as national security items or of national security interest in the past now have to be understood as having national security applications, because the Chinese government has been pioneering the national security exploitation of this kind of information. And so the old line between what is a defense item or a military item or a national security item on the one hand, and just a commercial item or a non-sensitive item on the other hand. That whole distinction has to be reexamined in light of all of this. And that's the reason that when the United States talks to other countries and says, we want you to be sensitive about the Chinese, we don't want you giving them too much access, and people say, well, tell us exactly what you want us to do, the United States doesn't always have a clear answer on exactly what we want them to do. Because this is a new challenge. And the Israelis have complained about that when American officials have talked to the Israelis. In some of these areas, some of the core interests are obvious. We don't want Chinese technology in running the internet in Israel to be used so that the Chinese have total access to the Israeli internet, for example, or the American internet. That was the fight about Huawei and its internet equipment. Is what that is an example of that.
Huawei.
So some things are clear.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I was going to say Huawei is not involved in Israeli 5G. It was going to be involved in British 5G, and it is in U.S. 5G. So really what you're talking about is something that goes beyond just U.S.-Israel relations and relates to America's dealing with a variety of allies.
That's absolutely right. And as I said, I mean, it's the Israel dialogue should be understood as part of a much larger project that the U.S. government is involved in around the world. And the way I look at it is, while some Israelis initially reacted in a defensive way and were kind of resentful of the United States coming in and raising these issues, others in Israel understand that this is really an opportunity for the Israelis, who are very skillful in technological fields, to work with the United States to develop the right way to think about these things in a cooperative fashion with the United States that can be a model of how the United States works with other allies and partners around the world. And I know that there are people in the U.S. government who are very, especially in this administration, who are very strongly in favor of good U.S.-Israeli strategic cooperation, who would welcome Israeli cooperation and input into refining not just Israel's thinking, but America's thinking on the ways to regulate economic relations with China, because nobody is talking about declaring China simply an enemy and trying to isolate it economically. We were able to do a substantial amount of isolation of the Soviet Union economically during the Cold War because the Soviet Union could be isolated economically. China really cannot. And so we're not talking about cutting off all economic relations between the United States and China, or we're not urging the Israelis to cut off all economic relations. What we're saying is the economic relations have to be regulated in light of Chinese strategy.
So this leads us to a question by a listener. Would you please comment on the Haifa port deal? Does that threaten the ability of the U.S. Navy to stop in Haifa?
There is a dialogue underway right now between U.S. officials and Israeli officials on Haifa port. Let me just give the quick background on what we're talking about. Some years ago, and it was actually probably 6-7 years ago or so, I don't know the exact date. I forget the exact date, but it was around 7 years ago or so. So that means before the full consciousness of what the Chinese are up to came even to the United States. That's around 7 years ago. The Israelis had an issue that for them was a purely domestic economic issue having to do with labor costs in Haifa port. And the dock workers were, through their union, getting payments that Israeli government officials feared would make Haifa port non-competitive. And so the Israeli government decided it wanted to build a new container facility at Haifa port. And they looked around for bids. There weren't that many countries that were interested in bidding. And the Israelis decided to go with a Chinese company, which not only could do the work, but would bring its own workers. So it was a way of basically dealing with this problem of too high payments necessary for Israeli dock workers. Anyway, the decision was made to give this contract to operate this new container facility in Haifa port to a Chinese state-owned company. And that company now has a contract to operate, beginning in 2021, this container facility for 25 years. And various people have raised the point that a Chinese presence in this facility for the next 25 years is going to give the Chinese access to the port, to Israeli internet systems relating to the port and port security and everything else. And it gives the Chinese a presence there and an opportunity for intelligence gathering there that is going to make the U.S. Navy nervous about using Haifa port as it has in the past. And now U.S. officials and Israeli officials have been talking about what is the nature of the problem, what are the measures that can be taken to mitigate the risks, and it is hoped that they can work out. I mean, the people who support strong U.S.-Israeli relations are hoping that they can work out an understanding and an arrangement that will satisfy the security concerns of the U.S. Navy and the U.S. government generally. The Israelis have been reasonably responsive, I am told by various American officials, but not totally responsive to the American concerns. And one example is when the Israelis made this decision, interestingly enough, they never brought the decision to a meeting where the Israeli military, the Israeli intelligence agencies, the foreign ministry, and other elements of the Israeli government were represented to do a 360-degree national security review of the Chinese investment in Haifa port. It was done based on considerations relating to the port and to the dock workers, and it was not looked at as a national security issue. And I, among others, made the point to the Israelis that in the United States, it wouldn't happen that way, that if there was a major Chinese investment in the United States, there's an organization in the U.S. government called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., and that's an interagency group with the Pentagon, the intelligence community, the Justice Department, the State Department, the Commerce Department, all involved, Treasury, and an investment would be reviewed from all angles for the national security implications. And Israel was urged to create a committee on foreign investment similar to what exists in the United States. The Israelis were responsive to the extent that they did create such a committee. They created it by executive order, as it were, rather than by statute. And they created it with certain loopholes that are making American officials unhappy. And so there's a fight. I mean, the basic view is it was good that the Israelis took a step in the right direction, but they didn't take a step far enough in the right direction. And so there's ongoing discussion about that. And I hope that the Israelis will be wise enough to take the step far enough so that American officials are properly satisfied with what they're doing to take legitimate American security considerations into account, and what's happening in Haifa will not damage the Navy-to-Navy cooperation or the defense relationship in general.
So let's look at countervailing interests. I have a two-part question here. Is there a, quote, China lobby in Israel pushing for expanded ties despite American objections? And has Beijing made inroads in Israel by sending students to Israeli universities, funding Confucius Institutes or similar agencies as they have done in this country, and engaging in diplomatic or other domestic persuasion campaigns?
The short answer is yes to all of those questions. And it's not surprising, it's not unique to Israel. Wherever the Chinese do substantial trade and investment, they have people in those countries who become advocates for closer cooperation and more accommodating policies toward China. And the Chinese have been very aggressive in what are called political influence operations, where they use their money, their trading leverage, to influence politicians, journalists, opinion leaders in the countries where they do business. And that's true in Israel also. So there are people in Israel that are saying, you know, we should be pushing back against the United States because we have such a strong economic interest in continuing to deal with the Chinese. And the Chinese do also have a strategy of reaching out to universities around the world and putting in their Confucius Institutes, which are engaged in some completely benign activities, but also some malign activities of propaganda and intimidation. And so the Confucius Institutes are represented in Israel. And the Israelis have to concern themselves with this. And this is one of the things that U.S. officials are concerned about. We have a problem of Confucius Institutes in the United States. So when American officials talk to the Israelis about this, we're not talking to the Israelis from the point of view that America has completely solved these problems for America. We're talking with the Israelis about problems that we're urging the Israelis to solve in Israel at the same time that we're trying to work out solutions for ourselves in the United States.
Thank you. I'm going to give us a last question. It's a thinker. The listener writes, the United States has consistently overestimated its ability to shape events in China and other countries. Why should Israel tie its destiny to a declining power that is falling behind in areas that China has become proficient in delivering globally?
Well, that question raises the fundamental question for Israel of where does Israel want to stand in the major strategic contest for the world in the future? I mean, if you view the major strategic contest in the future as being China versus the West, and the United States as the leader of the West, does Israel want to be in this new contest? I'm not calling it a Cold War, but it's somewhat analogous to the Cold War. Does Israel want to stand in this new contest on the side of the United States and the Western liberal democracies? Or does it want to stand with the Chinese? And I think most Israelis would understand that they have a strong set of interests that would put them on the American side, not least being that China has very close, friendly relations with some of Israel's biggest enemies, like Iran. And the Chinese do trade with Israel, but on political issues at the UN and elsewhere, they almost always side with Israel's enemies. There's a major danger that when the Israelis do trade in high technology with the Chinese and help the Chinese innovate and advance, that the fruits of the innovation and the fruits of the technological trade and the fruits of the academic exchanges that Israel has with China may be made by China available to the Iranians. And that's a concern for the Israelis. And so, I mean, I think it's healthy to ask fundamental questions, but I don't think that the fundamental question of should Israel choose to be on China's side or on America's side in the future is a very difficult question. I think it's pretty obvious that Israel has much stronger interests and, of course, much closer philosophical alignment with the United States and the West than it does with communist totalitarian China.
That, Doug, is a great answer. I knew you were going to come to a positive conclusion for us at the end of this call, and you just did it. I'm going to thank you on behalf of the participants and the Jewish Policy Center for a terrific call and a much better understanding of how China operates and how the U.S. and Israel operate. Doug Fife, thank you very much.
My pleasure.